U.S. Rule in Occupied Earth, or Everything You Need to Know About Genocide But Never Knew to Ask. Part 1. State of Exception. It would be a vast understatement to say that the word genocide is not well understood. In politics, in academia, and in normal everyday communication, the word is almost exclusively misused and abused. You might believe that the normal everyday usage, or sometimes the usage of those with the authority of knowledge, is definitive. What a word means is what meaning is given to it. In most cases, I would agree. The usage by ordinary people of a word is where the word usually derives its meaning. Not, however, when that usage contradicts itself. Not when that usage can only misrepresent the actualities that it purports to describe, and not when it is completely divorced from its original meaning. For example, a recent BuzzFeed article refers several times to the British attempting genocide against Aborigines in Australia. That makes no sense. Genocide isn't a single act like burglary. Genocide either happens or it doesn't. We don't refer to the genocide of Jews in World War II as attempted genocide. We don't even refer to an attempted genocide in Rwanda. People have a vague notion that genocide must somehow mean complete extermination, except that they are not consistent in that. Genocide is used in different ways according to political criteria. This isn't merely slippage, but it actually requires that people do not have an actual definition of the word. It is a word that has its meaning suppressed because the concept that the word represents is a dangerous concept. It is a concept which cannot be held on an ideological leash. It will drag the holder into the brambles of radical unorthodoxy rather than let itself be led to a park to chase a frisbee. Metaphorically, of course. Any limit to our vocabulary is a limit to our thinking. Our society, like all others, constrains our vocabularies so that some thoughts are unthinkable. We may live in a pluralistic, multinational, global culture that is in many ways organic and diverse, but the repression of thought to which I refer is systematic and purposive, and it is in the service of power. All languages have words or phrases that others lack, but I'm not suggesting that merely lacking a word for a concept is systematic repression. Instead, words like genocide or terrorism are stripped of stable, rational meaning whilst being vested heavily with emotive effect. This is the process that creates an orthodox idiom, which is to say, a systematically and coherently circumscribed mode of language and thought. These meanings are, as I've said, suppressed rather than erased. It would be wrong to view these words simply as empty signifiers, as if the arbitrary nature of language meant that one could exert one's will over language full control. That is a type of vulgar postmodernism, a megalomaniac fantasy such as Karl Rove was indulging when he said, quote, "We're an empire now. When we act, we create our own reality, and while you're studying that reality judiciously as you will, we'll act again, creating other new realities, which you can study too, and that's how things will sort out." End quote. Outside of Rove's self-aggrandizing fantasies, you cannot simply assign meanings to words at will. They must fit within a network of intelligibility that is grounded in a history of usage. Instead of simply redefining words, therefore, what orthodox usage does is to load a word with emotion and political ideology whilst suppressing its basic and fundamental defining characteristics. These characteristics may be more or less broad, more or less faceted, and more or less mutable over time. This loading of these words and this suppression of their original meaning leads to an unstable and contradictory usage. But that isn't a problem for the orthodox ideologue. Instead, it's actually a great boon to them. It allows the word to be used differently according to need. Furthermore, because of the emotionality attached, people will fight against attempts to reinstate a stable and comparatively objective usage. Genocide is exactly such a word. It first appeared in a work called Axis Rule in Occupied Europe, published in 1944. Its original meaning cannot be erased because it's part of a network of intercontextualized meanings which exist in history. At the same time, though, that meaning is thoroughly obscured. People argue that something is genocide because it is really bad, while other people argue you can't call something genocide because it's not bad enough to label it genocide, and that would be an insult to victims of real genocide. The meaning of genocide hasn't changed over time because the meaning was suppressed from the beginning. It always was a dangerous notion. People wrongly think that it was purely a response to the German atrocities that Winston Churchill referred to as, quote, a crime without a name, end quote. But Raphael Lemkin, who invented the term, had long been thinking on this topic, and what he described was far broader and more historically significant. And it didn't merely describe acts of mass murder, but made sense of them. It put them within a context, a strategic context. Unfortunately for Lemkin's future career, once the logic of genocide is grasped, it will reveal truths that are unpalatable and unacceptable, you know, depending on the political climate. In the 1950s, Lemkin devoted much of his attention to the genocides of indigenous people in the Americas, particularly North America. Lemkin established a clear intrinsic link between settler colonialism and genocide, and had he lived longer, he would inevitably have had to recognize that the link between genocide and all forms of imperialism was nearly as inescapable. Now, I say that because the sorts of violence and the institutions in settler colonialism he was looking at, he would have had to admit were also practiced in instances like the fighting the Philippines insurgency at the turn of the 20th century, but also, had he lived long, he would have seen things like the Agravilles and the strategic hamlet usage in Vietnam, and recognize that as quite a genocidal characteristic. But genocide is not, and never has been, something that you can just switch on and off. It's not a discrete act, as I kind of referred to this at the beginning. It's not something you attempt and either succeed or fail at. But it's also not distinct from war and militarism, nor authoritarianism and political oppression. The institutions of genocide that a state creates will not end until they are eradicated, and they won't be confined particularly to the genocide where they originated from. The German genocide in East Africa at the beginning of the 20th century created institutions that would later be institutions of genocide, but were also tools of repression used on political dissidents. Likewise, the institutions of genocide that are deployed in the Middle East and Africa today are continuations of genocidal practices that occurred in Asia and in Latin America, and they are already imprinted in the nature of policing in the USA and in the authoritarian rhetoric and policies of David Cameron and the Conservative government in the UK, for example. Now, many contemporary thinkers, from Sheldon Wolin and Giorgio Agamben to Jeff Halper and Chris Hedges, are trying to grapple with what an increasingly arbitrary state in its nature. States are becoming increasingly hostile to humanity, and people are living in an increasingly precarious situation where nothing that used to be guaranteed is guaranteed to them anymore. Now, when I refer to the state here, I'm referring not specifically to the government, but to this kind of nexus of government and private power that functions as a state. So, for example, you might have finance industry that exercises certain sovereign powers, and that is part of the state. So the state is the combination of governmental power and privately held sovereign power. Now, if we are to understand the situation of this increasing precarity, this increasing the decreasing level to which there is a reciprocity in the relations between state and citizen or subject. The greatest single step we could probably take at this time is to reacquire the term genocide. Lemkin used it to describe the phenomenon that was the driving force behind German occupations in Europe, but this also inevitably applied to Germany itself, even though that was not Lemkin's focus. For Lemkin, the concentration camp was the defining institution of genocide, but Lemkin meant the term broadly. When he was talking about concentration camps, he came to broaden that idea. He considered Indian reservations to be a form of concentration camp. And I think he would have conceded that it's the power structure created by barbed wire enclosures that is more important than the wire itself. For Agamben, Giorgio Agamben, the prevailing logic of the concentration camp is that of the inclusive exclusion. And he has contended that this is the biopolitical paradigm of our age. In this case, the term biopolitical in its broader sense refers to the way power exerts control over bodies. Political power controls human bodies. And I'll argue that on the large scale, the biopolitical becomes the demostrategic. You know, similar to you have geostrategy, which is strategy relating to geography, or demostrategic would in this construction be strategy relating to demography, large groups of people. So, at the large scale demostrategic level, this paradigm of power may express itself in the very phenomenon of genocide that Lemkin first described. And in a lot of ways, that shouldn't be a particularly contentious claim. After all, genocide is a response to groups of people as such. And I think that we have obscured the fact that there is a strategic purpose to that, because our discourse has become dominated with concepts of race hatred and so forth. However, I think that is to our disadvantage. So in this series of articles, I'm going to draw threads together that show that we need to make appropriate usage of the term genocide as a way of revealing a pattern of destruction and mass violence that is interconnected. And this is about instances such as the millions of deaths in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and it is also seen in the permanent dysfunction and instability of the so-called failed states like Somalia and Libya, but it's also seen in destructive state repression actions like Plan Colombia and the military occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan, but you can also see it in policies of mass surveillance, because they are aimed at people as such, and in something like the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. And you can look at a place like Haiti and see that there's been years of this sort of thing going on at a low level. And you can see it in the sort of instability and the political violence in Mexico, and of course you can see it in the so-called slow genocide against Palestinians being undertaken by Israel. And this is the nature of US rule on the occupied earth, or in occupied earth, because, you know, this is a system in which the US is hegemonic. However, of course, it's not exclusive to the US. This is also about Western Europe, or the Western world as a whole. But we are talking about an imperial system that is becoming increasingly genocidal. Sadly, even the best intellectuals seem to only vaguely grasp that the term genocide has an actual meaning. In contrast, those are more inclined to be opinionated, or generally less inclined to use cogent thinking, are only too happy to forcefully tell people that their usage is not only wrong, but it's offensive and dangerous. It's a bit like the poem by Yeats, "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." Israel Shamir, for example, and I'm not suggesting that Israel Shamir is the worst in any sense of politics or morals, but rather just in the fact that he defines genocide in the worst way. or the most useless way. Anyway, he has let his anger at the misuse of the term genocide, which is a very real phenomenon. We know that, you know, with people like Samantha Power writing books and going off and promoting the destruction of Libya, that the term genocide is widely misused, but he's let his anger at that obliterate his mental faculties. He recently wrote that Lemkin coined the word genocide, quote, in order to stress the difference between murdering Jews and killing lesser breeds. The word would be quite meaningless otherwise, end quote. He must know on some level that this is untrue, but he writes with thoughtless rage. The effect is to tell his readers not to even think about genocide. Quote, it would be good to ban this word altogether, end quote. Well, that is not going to prevent the misuse of the word. In fact, it plays into the hands of those who misuse the term in order to perpetuate aggression and genocide. So, the way to end the misuse is to treat the word genocide in the way you would treat any other word. When genocide is asserted, we should expect that the usage is justified on definitional criteria and also proportionate, so that you can't get away with accusing other people of doing something without recognizing you're doing it yourself. As it is, however, telling a readership that already opposes imperialism and Zionism that the word genocide has no meaning only makes it easier to exploit the term for propaganda purposes. Genocide is a word that itself exists in this kind of state of exception. People will scream at you for suggesting that it can be weighed or compared in any way with anything else. Even some genocide scholars call it a sui generis phenomenon, meaning that they want to say that it cannot be defined, but they reserve the right to label some things as being genocide on the basis that they themselves will know it when they see it. Moreover, there is a broad intellectual trend to treat genocide as a sacred word, which only special experts may employ, because any improper usage would be hyperbole and damaging to one's credibility. Sadly, this was the case on the radio program Against the Grain, which is one of my favourite radio programs, and it's broadcast from out of Berkeley by KPFA, which is a long-established non-profit radio station with great programs like that and also Flashpoints. Flashpoints. Anyway, Against the Grain is quite aptly named. In a world of growing anti-intellectualism, the interviewers and producers, who are C.S. Song and Sasha Lilly, do their work with a depth that is hard to find elsewhere in political analysis. They interview intellectuals with the sole aim of facilitating the transmission of ideas and information. No words are wasted on flattery or extraneous personal detail. Above all, when Song or Lily conduct an interview, they are very conversant with the material they are discussing. Most impressive to me, though, is that they never assume that the interviewee can't explain something to the audience. They don't try to avoid things on the grounds that they might bore or confuse us mere plebs. Instead, they chop them up with timely interjections so that they're digestible and so that the flow is maintained. In other words, they make it as easy for the audience as possible, but they don't pander in any way. Now, pandering is, of course, one of the great intellectual plagues of our age. Ideas that came from the realms of marketing and mass entertainment have spread to infect all corners of society. Part of this is the ideology, the disastrous ideology, of using a restricted vocabulary of words and ideas in order to never tax people's brains by asking them to learn something new. This is an obvious recipe for disaster. You cannot learn if you're never presented with anything you don't already know. Pandering in this sense makes people stupider on the whole, but it also makes substantive change impossible, because pandering is not just about avoiding inflicting the pain of thought on people, it's also about not disturbing ideology. In political activism, for example, pandering is is rife, and it's always represented as being tactical and realistic. You know, people are trying to aim their messaging so that it fits nicely with what people already believe, rather than changing what they believe. And quite often they're subverting their own ends in order to do so. That's why I appreciate a program like Against the Grain, because it generally doesn't do that sort of thing. However, if there is one thing on which people are guaranteed to pander in both intellectual and ideological terms, it's the topic of genocide. People mystify it and misuse it, and they sneer at people who dare to suggest that the US or Israel or the UK is committing genocide, because they know that anyone making such an accusation is just engaging in political sloganeering. This is supposedly debasing the coinage, which is a phrase used by the late Michael Mandel, who was a really brilliant guy who wrote the book How America Gets Away with Murder. It's a great book, but his idea that somehow using genocide in a way he didn't personally approve of was debasing the coinage was really kind of silly. And equally admirable people show that there's an identical opposite face to this debased coin, because they use the term genocide to raise the alarm on the world's horrors, not on the basis that it's appropriate to those horrors, but on the basis that they are horrific. A recent example of this was an interview with Professor David Isaacs on the plight of asylum seekers held on Nauru. What he revealed was absolutely alarming and inhuman and cruel, almost beyond description, and it is a situation that cries out for action. But then in the interview, he said, quote, he's said that he's told, quote, don't use the G word, the genocide word, or people will think you're too extreme. But he wants to use the genocide word because he thinks that the situation is extreme enough. And he is thinking exactly the same way that Mandel thinks, but from the other direction. In both of their constructions, genocide is a type of currency to be expended when our subjective sense of alarm tells us something is really, really, really bad. Now, for this reason, I was disappointed, but not exactly surprised, when the subject of the G word was broached on Against the Grain, and then treated as some special term whose applicability could only be determined by the most authoritative authorities. This was towards the end of an otherwise excellent interview about the plight of Sri Lanka's Tamils, 6 years now after the end of a 26-year-long civil war. Now, what was described by interviewee Anuradha Mittal is a textbook example of genocide. In genocide, the killing of the victim population as such is not the end, it is the means. And when he first coined the term genocide, Raphael Lemkin wrote the following. Quote, genocide has two phases. One, destruction of the national pattern of the oppressed group. The other, the imposition of the national pattern of the oppressor. This imposition, in turn, may be made upon the oppressed population, which is allowed to remain, or upon the territory alone after removal of the population and the colonization by the oppressor's own nationals. End quote. In other words, the sinalization of both the Tamil peoples and the land to which they belong is a defining genocidal characteristic, and this is what Mittal was mostly describing. The direct violence of genocide arises because resistance is inevitable. The deprivation of social, cultural, religious, economic, and linguistic capital is itself a form of violence which victims cannot help but resist. Mittal's interview reveals that it was the persecution and communal violence that initially drove some Tamils into the armed separatist movement. Now, in the aftermath of the long Bloody Civil War, she gives details of conditions based on a recently released report she authored. Once you understand the concept of genocide, what she is describing is in every aspect symptomatic of genocide. Everything she talks about is characteristically genocidal, from the way the hegemonic victor tries to enforce a certain historical narrative through memorials, to the way the land is imprinted with a state, military, religious, or linguistic character to alienate it from Tamils. In fact, the most salient and striking genocidal features are not the mass violence, but the unusual things, such as having the military run tourist resorts in the occupied territory. That sort of behaviour only makes sense in the context of genocide. At one point, Mittal quotes Dr. Rajani Tirunagama, quote, "Objectivity, the pursuit of truth, and critical, honest positions is crucial for the community, but is a view that could cost many of us our lives. It is undertaken to revitalize a community sinking into a state of oblivion." End quote. In that spirit, it is absolutely essential that genocide be understood for what it is. Without full and frank comprehension, it will never end, even if the intensity of direct violence waxes and wanes. Consider the persecution of Jews under the Reconquista, when Spain and Portugal were conquered by Christians 500 years ago. The persecution arose from a confluence of interests of state-building political elites, religious authorities seeking to increase power, and individuals looking to acquire land and other property. This sowed seeds of violence that would continue through the ages. The state sought to integrate the Jews as so-called conversos, but the state also sought to repudiate that conversion in order to enforce uniformity, to exercise religious authority, and to seize property. In other words, the conversos became the included exclusion, the very circumstance to which concentration camp inmates are subjected. From that came the concept of crypto-Jews, like Jews who weren't really, who pretended to be Christian but were secretly Jews. And this led to the ideological linking of Judaism with a cult conspiracy. Additionally, the concept of an ineradicable and heritable blood guilt was used, suggesting that even if they converted to Christianity, Jews were indelibly stained with the death of Jesus Christ. And this not only fueled future pogroms, but it arguably formed a key ideological foundation of racism, of modern racism anyway. In the same manner, until the genocide of the Sri Lankan state is comprehended, exposed, and repudiated by consensus, the ideological tools for future genocidal violence will remain intact. Tamil resistance, whether violent or not, will be delegitimized as terrorism, and this will in turn be used to legitimate violent and deadly repression. So this will continue until it is ended. That is why my heart sank so low when the conversation on Against the Grain turned to genocide. There was a general tone shared by Song and Mittal that was suggestive of the ultimate crime, which the exchange portrayed as being beyond mere war crimes. Then Mittal said that the question of whether genocide had occurred should not be prejudged, but should be decided by the, quote, international community, end quote. This makes me want to ask, what does that mean? Is it somehow above their pay grade to weigh the evidence? Is genocide something so controversial that only the high and mighty can pontificate on it? To me, this is anti-intellectualism. Mittal is tacitly stating that we should not think about such things, and that thinking should be left to the authorities. And what authorities are these? The term international community effectively means the US State Department, or what Noam Chomsky has labelled INTCOM. This is true regardless of the intent of the speaker, because if you promote the international community, then those who control the usage of that term in political discourse get to decide what that entails, and your original intent doesn't mean anything. things took a turn for the worse when Mittal brought the ICC into the conversation. Now, I don't know what mania is gripping people at the moment, but every advocate for victims of persecution seems to think that the solution will be found by putting people in the dock at The Hague. I think that this is some sort of woefully misplaced yearning for a corrective patriarchal authority figure. And it poisons our discourse on genocide and on war crimes. People think that wrongs must be righted by the exercise of power by the potent in order to grant some psychologically satisfying sense of balance. This is quite divorced from the practical realities, including that of actually ending today's atrocities rather than fixating on a small percentage of those that occurred a generation ago. I mean, does anyone actually look at the record of the ICC? There are some informed apologists for the ICC out there, but even they don't defend its actions thus far as much as they claim that it will do better things in the future. On the other hand, critics like David Hoyle cannot be countered except with speculation about how wonderful the ICC will be at some future point. Hoyle is an old Tory who may or may not be in the pay of the Sudanese war criminals, as some of his enemies would contend. But when he, a right-wing white man who was once photographed with a Hang Nelson Mandela sticker on his tie, debated the ICC in the pages of New Internationalist, he was far more convincing in suggesting that the ICC was institutionally racist than Angela Mudukuti, who argued that, quote, attempting to undermine its legitimacy with allegations of racism will take the global international criminal justice project no further, end quote. Now, it's well worth looking up this debate for the sheer surrealism of the fact that the young, bleeding-heart African woman effectively tells the old, hairy, white male Tory that he needs to be more trusting of the authorities or he will harm their efforts to run the world in an orderly manner. I mean, it comes to something, doesn't it, when you get a young, liberal African woman out Torying a Tory. Anyway, whatever one thinks of Hoyle, he has published a 600-page volume on the ICC, which is available online, which is full of substantive criticisms that stand regardless of his history or his motives. The fact is that if you don't accept that the ICC is both benevolent and a repository of expertise and authority, it's pretty difficult to see anything good in its patchy record of expensive and unacceptably lengthy proceedings, all of which have been against Africans. As an instrument of justice, it is inefficient, dysfunctional, and pathetic beyond belief. As an instrument of neocolonial domination, it is very expensive, but probably considered worth the price by European powers, who bankroll all of its activity. In fact, almost all of its money comes from the former imperial powers in Africa, which is some food for thought, really. But finally, as a propaganda instrument capable of making slaves scream out for more chains and whips, it seems to be priceless beyond measure. The fact is that many national courts and international bodies can choose to exercise so-called universal jurisdiction over cases of genocide anywhere in the world. The ICC is a very silly place into which to channel one's energies. But are prosecutions in general any better? There are two problems with the prosecutions such as those of genocide. And the first and most obvious in some ways is that the greatest criminals are in fact in charge of the international judicial system. But there is another one, and labelling genocide as a crime has in some ways become a very harmful distraction. This is an enterprise that involves massive bureaucracies and thousands upon thousands of people. It is a complex phenomenon, and to treat it as being some sort of simplistic moral event, such as like a decision to mug an old lady or something like that, does not actually give us room to understand the phenomenon properly. Is this more than anything that's turned the term into one that is so misused for political ends? Genocide is represented as being an act and being the crime of crimes that exists in a world of black and white morality, and its ultimate evil is used to justify great acts of violence and helps make people feel self-righteous when they act in this violent manner. People like to call for prosecutions because it is an instant source of gratification. The judicial system becomes a proxy instrument of violence, either as combat, defensive combat against someone, or as retribution after the fact. This is appealing to those who are in one way or another impotent. Prosecutors can symbolically be taking the role of their antecedents, the champions of the weak who fought in trials by combat. Sometimes the most fervent advocates of this form of state violence are pacifists. The problem seems particularly acute in the US, where the punitive impulse runs very deeply. But it's true all around the world. You might think that it is quite good that state violence be used on those who are found guilty of genocide, and, to the extent necessary, those accused of the crime, who of course must also be subjected to state violence if you're going to constrain them and present them to a court and so forth. And that's fine if you call it what it is, and that is retribution. But if you consider that to be justice, your concept of justice is retributive. I know that some would argue that the victims gain a sense of satisfaction and closure, but since the vast majority of the victims of mass violence never have access to this form of satisfaction, it is a rather hollow and bitter virtue. Now, people talk about prosecutions as if they have a practical, beneficial ramification of ending violence. But this flies in the face of the historical record. No one is ever prosecuted before they are in one manner or another defeated. In some cases, they might be the sacrificial offering by a criminal grouping that consolidates itself by allowing one member to be culled. But more often, it's simply a matter of victor's justice. The accused is defeated by hard power means before they are ever detained. They might be very guilty of heinous war crimes, but guilt is in fact incidental to a thoroughly political process. And again, this is going back to the fact that the greatest criminals actually control this process. It's like having a criminal court and a police force run by the mafia, and all the people that they arrest and prosecute may well be criminals themselves, but then again, they might not be. Meanwhile, ICC enthusiasts claim to be all about ending impunity. But if you actually just step back for a second, you'll see that the application of international criminal justice in the ICC, in the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, and in the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and in national courts, doesn't do much to end impunity. Instead of viewing cases like that of Charles Taylor and Slobodan Milosevic as villains who deserve punishment, imagine what message their prosecution sent to the world. It's the same message sent by the deaths of Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi, and that message is that the only hope for someone who is targeted by the US is to fight to the death. Making peace and going into exile or relinquishing power is not an option, because then they'll go after you even harder. The international criminal justice is only victor's justice against the vanquished and a neo-colonial weapon in fighting third world nationalists. Now, I mean, there are some exceptions to this, but these are exceptions such as produced by national courts at the moment in Chile and Argentina, and Tanzania, I think, is prosecuting a Chadian dictator, former Chadian dictator. But these are national courts exercising universal jurisdiction, and not bodies like the ICC. And what I should have said there is Senegal and not Tanzania, so sorry about that. Now, the only way someone responsible for mass violence might be prosecuted is when the real war is won on their home turf, which is what can often lead to these prosecutions in national courts. And that real war is an intellectual and moral struggle. It's the fight to expose the means and ends of those who commit mass atrocities, and above all, to vanquish apologetics. History shows that crimes do not end until the regime itself is recognized as criminal. It's not enough to recognize individual acts, or these sorts of crimes at least, they don't end until the regime is recognized as criminal. The individual acts can be recognized as crimes and the actors as criminals, but if you don't recognize the criminality of the regime, you can't end the ongoing crimes. A majority of US citizens once recognized US interventions in Indochina as war crimes, but it changed nothing because it was constructed as being a failing and a failure, not as a success, not as something inherent in the system, not as something functional to the empire. Now, fatuous pundits and lying politicians like to claim that the US relies on so-called international legitimacy, and this makes such criminal enterprises failures. But if you imagine if you examine the history of US war crimes and crimes against humanity, you'll see that they follow the Maoist principle that all power comes from the barrel of a gun. When they commit these crimes, they coerce other countries, including close allies, into treating them as legitimate. The real problem for the US regime that arose from these aggressions against Indochina was a dispersed and pluralistic domestic insurrection that might have consolidated into a revolution, and also a mutinous military. So once they had those problems solved, they went straight back to serial aggression and serial genocide, and many millions have died at their hands as a result. Therefore, it is necessary to create a consensus that the political establishment is criminal as a whole. Once that fight is won, you can try to move forward with prosecutions or with a truth and reconciliation process, such as in South Africa, if that's a better option. But prosecutions are not a road to change. You can't expect the corrupt institutions of a corrupt society to take any action that does not make the problem worse. And that's true on the international level as well, because the international institutions are controlled by a Western hegemonic coalition, condominium, an imperial condominium of Western powers. The best that a campaign calling for prosecutions can be is an awareness-raising campaign. If you really think that you can, that if you mobilize people and push hard enough, some top-down bureaucratic judicial body will make a positive difference, then you really need to start thinking again about what sort of world you're living in, because I think you're living in a dreamland. We don't need to lock Bush and Blair in prison. We need to delegitimize them and disempower them and disempower those who support them and end the criminal regimes of which they were merely transient and still are merely transient components, because they're still acting for these imperial criminal ends. It is true that if George W. Bush were in prison, he wouldn't be able to charge $100,000 to give a speech for a charity raising money for amputee veterans. But as grotesque and freakish as that is, the Bushes, the Clintons, and Tony Blair only get so much money because a whole stratum of society worships power. And that's not going to go away if we lock up one or two of them. In a situation that is equally reminiscent of pre-revolutionary France and Nazi Germany, our elites simply do not have functioning morals. Without coercion, they will never even acknowledge a moral component to the exercise of power, but will fawn all the more over those that commit war crimes, because that is an exercise of great power. The importance in understanding the complexity of the phenomenon of genocide is that once it is understood, you won't be able to look at US foreign policy again and say, oh, they don't know what they're doing, they're making a mistake, why do they keep making the same mistakes, I could run things better than them, this is ill-informed policy, they're wrong-headed, and so forth. Perhaps this is a bit of a disadvantage in some ways. But once you understand the nature of genocide, it's very clear that their policies are all very cogent and follow a clear plan that serves imperial purposes. Now, as I continue these talks, I want you to bear in mind the contrast between this idea of genocide as a complex phenomenon, a type of warfare, warfare against people because it is a demo-strategic imperative. Compare that with the idea of genocide as a crime, where you get one person and say, this person committed genocide, we are going to put them in court and show that they are guilty and we are going to lock them up of this crime. And you can see why, when you start thinking about it in those terms, that I find the discourse of the criminality of genocide to actually be quite destructive. And furthermore, I'm going to spend some more time yet on discussing this intellectual simplistic nature of the discourse on prosecutions and why I think this is really about a psychological imperative to make people feel better about themselves, not a genuinely well-founded intellectual or moral stance. So I will continue in part two, which is called Days of Revolt.